Thank you. My name is Dick Anderson. I am alcoholic. Amen. And, you know, for a group of people who've been told they have a fatal disease, you guys are having a lot of fun. My home group is the Macklin Group. It's in Powder Springs. My official job there is I am a greeter. And we started having greeters about 3 years ago, and the size of our group then was about 15, 20 people. And we started greeting. We started making sure everybody who joined our group had a job. And then the problem that developed, we had so many newcomers joining our group that we had to start a beginners meeting on the same night as our regular meeting so that the beginners wouldn't interrupt the regular meeting. And now we've got 25, 30 people in the beginners meeting and maybe 80 people out in the regular meeting. So this is what I was taught when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I never went to an AA meeting where I didn't feel like I was loved and wanted. And one of the things that does that is being a greeter. So I enjoy being a greeter at my group. We meet on Thursday night, 8 p.m. out at Macklin Presbyterian Church. And come join us if you can. I want to thank my host, Jimmy. He offered, I didn't really need anything, but I appreciate it, and he did offer everything, and he was, as usual, for this roundup, very cordial, gracious, I want to thank Brenda and Sally, and I want to thank all the committee for allowing me to share, and I want to thank Tony, my friend Tony C., for asking me to share. She was on the committee when they made the decision to ask me. And especially enjoy the honor of sharing at the Atlanta Roundup. I speak a lot of places, but this is the first time I've been allowed to speak here. This is our 75th anniversary in AA. This is our 35th anniversary of the Atlanta Roundup. And I'm coming off of this. We went to the Founders Day, and there were 20,000 people up there celebrating, and it was just fantastic. And then we went out to San Antonio, and went to my 7th International out there and celebrated the 75th anniversary, and another fantastic experience. And now being able to celebrate in this is just, it's going to be kind of a letdown after this, but it's been a great few weeks. As I said, this is my 32nd Atlanta Roundup. My first or second Atlanta Roundup, Bill R., the guy that was up here giving away the big books, had me and Leroy, I don't know whether Leroy is here or not, dressed up in blue blazers and ties out in the parking lot. We had to wear a coat and tie to make sure that we would help people find a parking space. And that's the way this was. The Atlanta Roundup has always been like that. Since then, I've been a volunteer. I've chaired one of the meetings, was a host, I think, one time, got on the executive committee, and I actually chaired the 25th anniversary 10 years ago. But I love this roundup, and I love it because of this. It sets an example for other roundups in terms of behavior. If you notice, everybody on the committee is well-dressed. The language up here has been exemplary. The message up here has been exemplary. There's been a lot of power at this program. There hasn't been a lot of off-the-wall talking. It's all been about Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that keeps us sober. And that's the way this thing has been for 35 years and the way I hope it'll be for the next 35 years. And I especially want to thank all the new and younger people that are taking the committee and taking it that way and keeping it that way, because we thank you, and I appreciate it very much personally. So... And I'd also like to thank the people that were here when I first came. Bill's one of the few people that's still here, but Joe Hubbard and Joe Phelan and George and Marge Montgomery and John Holmes and many of the other people that were here, because they started this for us, and I went to the second one. And I think that's where Bill had Leroy and I out there. But we got a job. We were helping people find a place to park. And we felt like we belonged, and it was a big celebration. This was started as a way for everybody in Atlanta. In the earlier days, everybody kind of knew each other, but Atlanta was getting big enough 35 years ago that sometimes you wouldn't see each other because you'd be on opposite sides of town, and the idea was for us to at least once a year all get together and celebrate the gift of sobriety. And it's been a great experience. So I want to... In fact, the speakers this weekend, we've always had good speakers at the Atlanta Roundup. I've never heard a bad speaker here. I've heard plenty of people that have gotten up, really, because the speakers have been people who've been respectful of the podium and reverent to this program. And that's just been the tone of this roundup for as long as I can remember. And we've got a lot of miracles that are up here. Jack survived 4 pipe bombs he talked about last night. Jewel survived the Sanssouci. You do not want to miss Michael tomorrow, and Michael is the female alcoholic tomorrow, and especially her burning bush story. And that's truly a miracle. It's one of those miracles that God shows God has a sense of humor, but it's a miracle nonetheless. I just love the speakers. They're friends of mine. I love them. But I must say that the best speaker of the weekend was the Al-Anon speaker today. No, I must say that my wife, Barbara. But there is a difference. We come in, we share a common defiance. God's been trying to reach out to us all along, and all of us come in here with this common defiance. And the only way we come in here is because we have no other choice, most of us. But we are not alike in our circumstances. All the other AA speakers will tell you that they came from families where alcoholism was a major a part of the family. But I didn't have any drinking in my family. I'm the first alcoholic of record in my family. I did not come from a family of drinkers. At our family get-togethers, we had iced tea, we had lemonade, and we had... I came from a family not of money, but a family of honor and will kids, because up until a few years ago, I was kind of... Growing up in high school, I didn't want to tell anybody what kind of family I came from, because I came from a military family, and some of the kids I went to school with who were in I was in a gifted program, were kids that, in fact, came from families of money, and we didn't have much money. Military people don't make much money. And so I really wouldn't tell anybody, because I was almost embarrassed when I was younger that that's the kind of family I came from. But I mentioned earlier today, my dad was one of the most decorated pilots in World War II. He was back flying P-51s when he met my mom, who was a stewardess for American Airlines. American Airlines flew them to Acapulco, and 9 months later, I was the gift that arrived. And my dad is just one of many in our family. My little sister is a retired Burt Colonel, well-decorated. Her husband is a retired Burt Colonel. Their boy graduated from West Point. Of the grand generation down, we have 6 that served and 3 that were special forces and 1 Marine. When you go back, I'm named for my great-grandfather, who was Richard Heron Anderson, who was a 3-star general under Robert E. Lee. He was named for his grandfather, who was a... Richard Clo Anderson, who was a general under George Washington. In fact, he had the boat that went across the Delaware River on Christmas Day in 1776. That's the family I came from, and I was a little embarrassed to tell you about because we didn't have as much money as other people. But I didn't understand where power came from. I thought money was power. Now I understand power as being humility. And the family that I came from was a humble family. They were a family that served. They didn't go to the VFW and drink and tell war stories. They just were willing to serve their country. They didn't get involved in the politics of it. But they helped found this country and help preserve it and help keep our freedom. And now I'm very proud of that family. But I did not fit in. This is, if you Google, here's my great-grandfather, and it says he's a Richard Heron Anderson was a career U.S. Army officer fighting with distinction in the Mexican-American War. He also served. Uh-oh, sorry. She told me not to read. She warned me earlier. Was a career U.S. Army officer fighting with distinction in the Mexican American War. He also served as a Confederate general during the American Civil War under Robert E. Lee. Anderson was also noted for his humility. And there comes the rub. I knew that I didn't fit into my family from the very beginning. And I really did. I just felt like I didn't fit in, and I couldn't tell anybody why I didn't fit in, because I didn't have a sponsor. And if you're new in AA, we have something that's great. It's a great thing. It's called a sponsor. There's a guy in this room, Bill, knows everything there is to know about me. There's another guy in Hilton Head that knows everything there is to know about me, and they accept me anyway. They help me to become a better person. They work with me each year, and they love me. But I didn't have somebody like that when I was a kid, so I didn't know who to tell that, you know, I don't fit into this family. They're all heroes. They go off and do this thing. I don't fit into that family. I'm more concerned about stealing a nickel from my mother so that I can get a candy bar at Wish's Drugs. And that's the way I was. So I couldn't tell anybody. All of the activities I was involved in also taught me the same kind of attributes that my family held. I was in Little League, YMCA, 4-H, Vacation Bible School, Boy Scouts. And if you remember in Boy Scouts, we had a code that says the way we please God best is to do something for another person anonymously each day. And that's exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I couldn't get it. If you are an alcoholic like me, the only way that you can get to this spiritual life is through this secret decoder book called The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't invent any of this, but I didn't get it until I got my decoder book. I didn't get it until I got here and got that decoder. So I did, however. I felt estranged. I felt estranged from people. I couldn't tell my Little League coach or the Boy Scout leaders what was going on with me. But something else that happened in the 50s as I was growing up, there was an invention of a small little box like this called a television. It was small, had black and white pictures on it. And I felt and got connected to the characters in that TV. And I felt more at ease and more really connected with the people on TV than I did the people in real life. And that became the place where I went to relax, to be with the people, to have fun, and also it became my moral compass. And the shows weren't bad. They were Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, The Andy Griffith Show. And if Opie or Wally ever got off the beam, by the end of the show, Dad had taken his pipe, turned it to one side, and without judgment, which was very important because I grew up in a Baptist church, without judgment, he would say something, and Opie or Wally got the message and got back on the beam. And so this became the place that I would go and I would take my problems. And if I had a problem, Opie or Wally usually had a similar problem. And I found out how to deal with these things. So I complied. I did the things I was supposed to on the outside. I was good in sports. I was good at athletics. I was good in music. But I was inside, one scared little Baptist Boy Scout who felt disconnected from people. Now, I saw one thing that you had, or other people had, and that was this brightness and this smile, and I thought it was because of God. I heard about God a lot. We went to church a lot, and I saw people in church that seemed to be happy, and they weren't bothered by things, and so, but I didn't know how to get to them. The big book says lack of power is our dilemma. I certainly didn't have the power that my family had. Now I'm looking for this power someplace else. Maybe it's there in church. And I end up having a spiritual experience at the drive-in, East Drive-In, with my dad, my sister, little sister, the soon-to-be retired Burke Colonel. And we go to the drive-in, and there up on the screen is a movie in color. Not only color, but Technicolor, and it was 120 feet wide, and it was power incarnate. It was the story of Moses. It was the Ten Commandments, and I made a decision. I looked up there, and here was this man who just took a staff and pushed it to one side. The wind would blow through his hair, and the Red Sea would part. And I watched that movie, and I made two decisions. One, I want to be around whatever that is, the movie. I don't know how you do that, but I want to be part of that. And God was listening. That's pretty much what I've been around doing for my entire life. The second thing that happened, I decided that I wanted to be on God's side because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so so the next day, much to the surprise of my parents, who did not know I was having a spiritual experience in the back of the 55 Ford, I went down the aisle at Linden Baptist Church and got dipped and dunked. And I had an emotional experience, and they were playing a song called We Surrender All, or I Surrender All. Obviously, I'm not a, what is it, church lady? Okay, I Surrender All. So they're playing this, and I surrendered all, you know, 3.5 feet of me, and I go down the aisle, and I did the same thing as a newcomer who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I gave it all this emotional. I jumped in there. I was ready to go, but I didn't do anything to change. I didn't take one step to change, and I didn't talk to anybody because they didn't have a sponsor in this particular Sunday school thing. So after a few days, when I didn't change, my feelings were the same. And I still felt like this scared little Baptist Boy Scout, and so I felt like God was there for you, but not for me. I never doubted there was a God, but I doubted God was there for me. So now I don't fit in with humans, and I don't fit in with God. And that's pretty much the way I was until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had my next spiritual experience when I was 14. A buddy of mine and I were playing Babe Ruth League baseball. I was the center fielder. He was the left fielder. His older brother got us a six-pack of beer and a half pint of gin. He drank the gin, and I drank the beer. Now, I'd never even seen alcohol in person before because we didn't have it around. But I drank this beer, and something happened. I was transformed, and all the things that I imagined Moses must have felt when he got ready to cross the Red Sea, I felt, because suddenly I felt like I was about 10 feet tall. All of the pain, the fear, all of those things, the knots in my stomach, they were gone. And I just felt like I could stand up straight. And from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk. And going to town when you're 14 means hitchhiking. And at that time of night, the only place to hitchhike was a place called the White Castle. And I don't know, they don't... A White Castle is like a downscale version of the Crystal. And it's a place where you go at midnight to get a dozen of those cheeseburgers with all the little onions on them that seem like they're a real good idea when you're drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning. So we go, and I had been very timid out in public with anybody who wasn't my age, and suddenly I am... Barbara talked about me liking to table hop. I was table hopping. I was meeting new people. I had several new friends. There was a very attractive redhead behind the counter. I think she was married, but what did I care? And I was having something was going on between us. But my buddy Dave, my buddy Dave was not having the same spiritual experience, and he was getting a little woozy. So Dave decided he would, I had never had a cup of coffee either, but I had seen in Perry Mason, when you have too much to drink, you have a cup of coffee and it sobers you up so you can talk to the police. So I ordered a cup of coffee from my buddy Dave, and it did not have the desired effect. Dave threw up down the stainless counter. And as it turns out, if you're looking for a Louisville City policeman at midnight, the best place to find him is at the White Castle. And so two of them came down, asked me what was wrong with my friend. I said, he's just had a little bit too much to drink. How old is he? 14. How old are you? 14. So I was in Louisville City jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested 22 times, only once for a DUI, and none for crimes of commerce. I didn't make any money off of any of them. They were all acts of defiance. I was the guy, if my buddy was stopped along the side of the road and there was a policeman there, I pulled in behind and I said, "Officer, what's the problem? This is my friend." And my friends loved me because they all ended up going home, and I was the one that was in handcuffs on the way to the jail. Now, if you can imagine living in a house, the kind of house that I lived in, which was a very disciplined house, I got the, if you're going to live like that, you can't live under this roof. So I, as a sophomore in high school, was living with some older kids in an apartment outside, would only go home long enough to blackmail my mother occasionally for something, and so they never knew where I was. And do you know that I was in AA for several years before I realized how much hurt that causes a family? I didn't know. And because I was concerned with me. Now, here's the other thing. I would have told you when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that my drinking problem started the last 2 years of my drinking. During those 2 years, I was in a basement apartment over here in Atlanta, and I was not paying my rent. And because I wasn't paying my rent, I couldn't tell them there was water on the floor. And I was living on a bathroom floor, and I would drink. And I would wake up, get the dry heaves, drink, get a little bit of alcohol down, stop the shaking, watch the TV on the bathroom floor, pass out, and come to again. And the only time I left was to walk up to the liquor store to buy some whiskey. And I would have told you I had a problem then. But the first 3 times I took a drink, the first time I take a drink, I get locked up, and nobody in my family has been locked up. but I can't wait to go back again. The second time I drink, and one of the kids got us something called, that I would recommend if you're going to have a slip, called cherry vodka. And it goes well with Tia Maria. And and the third time I drank what I drank until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. And I can tell you that the first time I sipped any of those beverages, they didn't taste good, but it got me there quicker. During that time, I had one human being that I was connected with. And I was the quarterback on the JV football team. She was the captain of the JV cheerleaders. We talked on the phone every night for 2 or 3 hours. We went to hayrides together. We went to movies together. We went to the very first James Bond film together. We were absolutely infatuated with each other. Nothing, and there were a couple of guys that asked her out, nothing could get between me and her. And after she found out about my second drinking experience, she called me and said, I haven't told you this, but my dad has a drinking problem, and when he drinks, he gets mean. And because of that, I haven't shared that with you, and I would like for you not to drink when we go out. And I broke up with her just like that. The most important person in my world, and the only person I was really connected to, and as soon as she got between me and alcohol, and I'd only had something to drink 3 times, I dropped her. Now, somebody could have told me I was an alcoholic. In fact, some people did, or told me that I had a drinking problem back in those days, but I wasn't ready to do anything about it. So I started to drink as much as I could around the clock. I was a daily drinker, a morning drinker, an afternoon drinker, a noon drinker when I was in high school. I drank Country Club malt liquor before I went to school. I drank at lunchtime. We got out early, and I started drinking whiskey, and that's the way I was. I got locked up 6 times my senior year in high school. I got locked up at my senior prom. By now I'm 18 years old, for 2 counts of assault and battery on a police officer. Well, we have an event in Louisville, Kentucky, at the same time as prom, and it's called the Kentucky Derby. And a few people come to town, and it gets a lot of press. And so I went to a high school that had about 2,000 kids, and 2 of them were black, and I got along with them, so I thought I knew all about race relations. And that night, I got locked up for 2 counts of assault and battery on a police officer, and looking back on it, I think the policeman put me in this particular cell on purpose. But they put me in a cell. My parents didn't know where I was because, again, I was out in an apartment in high school, and but they thought I was going to go to the prom, and the next morning they found out exactly where I was because on ABC, CBS, and NBC News, they showed my cellmates, 7 Black Panthers, coming out. They'd been arrested for trying to blow up Churchill Downs. This is back in the 60s. And so the 7 Black Panthers come out for arraignment, and right behind them is me in my little powder blue, my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. And see, the other kids at school, they were studying, getting ready to go to Harvard, Brown, Yale. They didn't get to do things like this. And I drank as much as I could. I had made good enough scores to get into Brown or Harvard or any place when I was in the 8th or 9th grade. I was in an accelerated program. But because of my behavior, I barely got out of school. My uncle was the dean at the University of Kentucky and helped me get in down there. And they had to accept you if you were a state student, I thought. But he had to help me get into the University of Kentucky because of my behavior. I went down there, and now I was still continuing to watch movies, and they were very important to me. I watched The Graduate. I made it all the way through high school without smoking, and got out. I watched The Graduate 10 times, and started smoking. Had an affair with an older woman. She'd be about 89 now. And, you know, this affair was out at Lake Tahoe. I had a summer job at Lake Tahoe, and I spoke at Lake Tahoe about 5 or 6 years ago, and I'm telling the story, and said, my God, she might be in this room, because she could drink, too. But I lived in this fantasy world, and when I was drinking, I could pretend to be whatever I was, wherever I was, just like watching TV. So for me, the drinking thing got me into a place where I was in a pretend world the whole time. And so I was out there. I came back. I was going to UK. I was still reading some, you know, and everybody in my family was West Point or Annapolis. or you know, at least ROTC. And I was in ROTC, but I was sitting down one night reading a lot of Hemingway. We sat, we drank, we enlisted. I did not want to miss out on Vietnam. Now, this is while I'm drinking. I didn't want to miss out on Vietnam. So I went down and enlisted and ended up in Vietnam. I had two tours in Vietnam. And I seemed to do okay in combat. This is the strange thing. I had no idea how to deal with life. But as soon as there was something life and death threatening, I did okay. I was actually never got in trouble, and I was well decorated. I can't explain that. It's a gene. But it doesn't have anything to do with. But I realized I did not have a career in the military because you have to get up in the morning. So I decided I was going to get out, and a friend of mine, my drinking buddy, was a gunny named Frank, and Frank was, he had set it up for me to meet this very nice, attractive woman. I met her, and he was in Louisville. He had gone back to Louisville, and we'd worked together over in Vietnam. And so now I go and have dinner. I meet this woman. I'm absolutely infatuated. Everybody I was ever engaged to in those days was somebody who was looked like somebody in the movies. I got engaged to a girl after seeing the Romeo and Juliet movie that looked like Olivia Hussey. But this girl looked like Olivia Newton-John, and I was absolutely infatuated, and I decided to move back to Louisville. I got a job. I discovered I was a good writer, and I had done a lot of writing early on. I got a job at an ad agency. I was working and writing, producing commercials, and she and I were working on when we were going to, like, getting married. We just need to figure out what to do with her husband. And, he was gone a lot. He was an advance man for Nixon, who was running for re-election, and so he was out a lot, so he came back. I was trained. I was an expert marksman when I was in the service, so we had a few run-ins. I went after him a few times with a shotgun. He came after me a few times with a warrant, and but you know how we are. We persist. We do not let go, and I just kept persisting. I got in there, and finally, I got them broken up, and we get ready to get married, and we're about 3 weeks away from the wedding, and the wedding gifts are coming in to the apartment, and everything seems like good. Now, I was a around-the-clock drinker, so I didn't have blackouts. A lot of people who drink all the time don't have blackouts. But I would go on binges occasionally on top of the drinking all the time. I don't know how that works, but anyway, I would go on binges. So I apparently went on a binge, I'm not sure why, maybe to celebrate the impending marriage, and I lost a couple of days. When I do that, I would lose a day or two. And I came in about 3 weeks before the wedding, and so I was going to lose a couple of days. She said, "Where have you been?" I said, "I don't know, really." And so she was concerned. And so she decided that we would postpone the wedding. And when anything ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, when I was drinking, not in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was drinking, I always blamed other people. And so when she told me there was a problem and she wanted to postpone, I blamed her and I was angry. And I had to comfort me. And the only way I could comfort me was basically to drink more. But I couldn't drink any more than I did. And I grew up in Kentucky, and I never saw drugs when we were in high school. And I'm not saying that I didn't smoke a few joints or accidentally do LSD on a plane ride one time. But Wild Turkey 101 was my prime thing. And so, while I was in Vietnam, we had had this one, you know, they would give you things to try, products to try, like I'd never had Coors beer or Ham's beer, because it's way on the other side of the country. And so, they had it there and we tried it. It was a nickel a beer. Well, they also had this new magazine. I had, seen Playboy in the United States before I left. And for those who are very young and have the internet, anything racy was not, the raciest thing growing up was the National Geographic, the tribal section for us. But I had seen, they'd come out with Playboy, and I could kind of look at Playboy, but we go over there, there's this magazine called Penthouse, and Penthouse had a section in there called the Forum, or Letters, where they had these intellectual ideas that we would discuss among ourselves. And so there was an idea in there called a menage a trois. And we didn't speak French at the time, apparently. which is interesting because we were in French Indochina, but we didn't really know that either. It was just get on the helicopter and then get back. But we're having, and you know, that was one of those, like, you know how you read something and you just kind of connect with it. And so I thought this would be, and I had actually brought this up from time to time with my fiance, usually at intimate moments, but her having formerly been married to a Nixon aide, she was a little conservative, so she wasn't going for that. So now I'm trying to find out where to have a menage. My fiance has cast me out. I'm hurt and I'm wounded. I'm trying to find this menage, and I'm bringing this up because this is the kind of trouble you can get into without a sponsor. There was another section in there, and I thought if I'm going to have this menage, I want to be able for the two girls to like each other. And so so there was another concept in there that I can tell you now that I really did not understand called lesbian. And so so I am now looking for a lesbian bar in Louisville, Kentucky, over 40 years ago, to find two girls who want to have a menage a trois with me. The apartment complex that I lived in had about 11 of us. We all knew each other. You needed a reference to get in there. We were all veterans, very conservative, Marine Corps, Army, stickers all over the place. So I can't ask these guys because they're a little straight. I'm a writer, so I'm more experiential. And so but you know how we are. We do not give up. And so I kept trying, and finally somebody said, go down to this place. So I go down to this place on a Saturday night, and I go in there, and there are only two people in there. There's a guy playing the piano, and there's a woman at the piano bar. And so I'm talking to her. We're getting along fine, but she's a veteran, but I can tell we're not going to be doing any menaging. But you know, I told you I'm smoking four packs of cigarettes now. They're L&M's because I like the attractive couple and the autumn leaves on the cover. And so I'm smoking that. I'm drinking my Wild Turkey 101. No water, thank you. Don't want to bruise the flavor. And so I'm throwing back Wild Turkey and drinking. You get just enough cigarettes and enough whiskey, and you get that sexy kind of come hither voice. And you are not going to get any sexier. And I'm waiting, and all of a sudden, just like in the movies, a door opened on the other side of the room, and it opens up, and there was this cascading staircase, and I don't know how I missed it when I came in, but there was this strikingly beautiful woman. Something had been going on upstairs, and this strikingly beautiful woman with red hair, it looked like the beginning of the Loretta Young show. If you're young, Google it. But Loretta Young was a striking woman. I don't know what color her hair was because TV was black and white. But anyway, so they're coming down the staircase just like this. It's this beautiful redhead, and just about where Katie is. And just coming down the staircase, and suddenly our eyes met. We go to the middle of the dance floor, and we're holding on to each other, and we're kissing, and we just cannot get enough of each other. And I'm in love. And you know, when you're in love, you take three steps over this way, and then you start kissing again because you don't want it to go away. You found your partner. And then I remembered my mission. I said, by the way, do you have a girlfriend who could join us? She said, oh, are you into that? And I said, oh, yes. And she said, so she said, well, why don't we get to know each other tonight, and we'll add somebody else tomorrow? And I'm saying, thank God I did not marry that Republican woman. And so we're holding hands, we're going back, and it's Saturday night, and at the place where I lived, whoever got up first on Sunday morning, popped the keg out by the pool, rang the bell, we started playing volleyball in the pool, and if you had a stayover, a lot of the guys were married, but if you had a stayover, you would take her out to introduce her to all your alcoholic friends. It was a great life. And so I'm thinking, this is one good-looking redhead, and I'm really going to enjoy this morning. Now, I was a little snobbish about drugs because I felt like if you did drugs, you lacked self-discipline. And so she pulls out a pill, and we get back to my place, that was big enough to choke a horse. In fact, it was a Quaalude, which it turns out is a horse tranquilizer. And so and said, would you care for one? And I said, oh, no, thanks. I don't do drugs. And so I took another shot on my Wild Turkey, and two things happened. Erica passed out, and I found some equipment I definitely wasn't looking for. And after 3 or 4 days, I said, this is not right. This is the point at which my moral compass stopped working, because I had never seen Opie or Wally ever deal with this in any episode. And it was, things weren't going all that well, as you can see, in all of my love life, and my work life was pretty much the same. I got fired from my last 5 jobs when I was drinking, but I always managed to know that I was going to get fired, so I managed to get something else. So I actually had gotten a job. I was very good at the work that I did, writing and producing. I could do it for an hour a day and do really well. And so I had gotten a job. I had won several regional awards, and I'd gotten a job with the world's largest ad agency up in New York. So I left Louisville thinking that was my problem and went to New York City, and I was working for the world's largest ad agency, writing and producing Coca-Cola commercials. I stayed at the Barclay Hotel for a long time while I was up there, and at the Plaza Hotel, and they had a suite at both. And I flew around on Learjets, and you would think that this would be the opportunity of a lifetime. And it was in some ways. I won a couple of Clios. I did a commercial that they tried out each year at Super Bowl time that you see. I have worked on a lot of the Coke stuff that was fun to work on. It was great. It was an opportunity of a lifetime. And I was one of the youngest creative directors that they had. I was good for a very short time during the day. And this was during the time, there's a show out about the advertising business now. This was during the time when everybody drank. There was a bar in the office. So they only expected me to get the work done, and then I was gone. But things were starting to happen. Things were starting to break down. There's a TV series out called Royal Pain now about going out into the Hamptons and the very well-to-do. And I had never been around people with that much money, but I was invited on one occasion. And I showed up kind of like the kid in Caddy Chase, where I had the little all-white outfit to go on the yacht and that kind of stuff, which, as it turns out, is not a good color for an alcoholic, because while laughing, I was getting to the point where I was having a little bit of a problem with certain controls. I laughed a little bit too hard, and I had a little poopy in the white pants. So, I did not get invited back into the Hamptons. And actually, I was drinking around the clock, days, but I was in a studio one morning, and I thought I had worked out a regime so that I was at least sedated most of the time. I didn't use that word, but so that I was not, as we used to say, quick. And I was in a studio one morning, and we were doing some music. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And we didn't have computers then, so this was lots of singers, lots of musicians, and a very important responsibility. But I got in there, and my mouth wouldn't work. I couldn't talk. And so I had to leave. I just left everybody in there in the studio and walked around to find the first bar I could find. It was a little hole in the wall. It was one of those bars where you sit down and you're looking in a mirror 5 feet away. You can see yourself. They had those pickled whatever. I didn't get bad enough to eat those, but they had those pickled things on the bar. And I walked in, and this guy poured me a triple, and he didn't know me. He poured me a triple whiskey. And I thought, I wonder how he knows I'm a big drinker. Because that's the way I thought of myself, as a big, two-fisted whiskey drinker. And I didn't realize what I looked like. And I took it, and I shook it all over the bar. And I'd seen another movie called Lost Weekend with Ray Milland, where he takes this towel and uses it as a lever to pull this up to his lips. And I got the drink up that way. And then I got another triple down, and it took the edge off, and I went back. But before I did, I looked in that mirror, and I saw somebody I did not recognize. I looked like a 45-year-old street drunk. And I was 25 years old. And because of what was going on, they didn't fire me. They banished me from New York to Atlanta. That's what happens if you're bad. They send you to Atlanta. And so they sent me down here, and so I could be kind of closer supervised. And I was living in that basement apartment. I got fired shortly thereafter, because if you don't show up for work, it turns out they fire you eventually. And because they had a big account with a bank, I used that to my advantage to keep running bad checks out there. And eventually, though, and that's when I got into the cycle, I was drinking, and I would come to, and I would dry heave, and I would get some alcohol down, and I would go back. I was bleeding from my stomach. I was hallucinating. I was hearing voices coming out of the heating duct. because I didn't have any food my last 2 years. All I did was live on alcohol. And so I ended up eventually getting evicted from that apartment. And when they evict you, they don't give you 6 days or a week. They give you 6 weeks or 2 months notice, but that's never enough time for an alcoholic. And so the night before they were putting me out on the street, and I had no furniture. I just lived on the bathroom floor. I really didn't have any furniture. And I had a TV, and that was it. And I had a pair of pants. I had learned from the yachting incident. I had a pair of pants that was country club, kind of a yellowish brown, and which ended up being a very practical color, a blue knit shirt, and a pair of loafers that had holes in the bottom, and that's all I had. But I was paranoid, very paranoid, during my last 2 or 3 years, and I carried a .45 in my pocket. And so so I went up. I was being evicted, and I go up to the liquor store, and the guy said, just a minute, and the owner came out, and he said, we know that check you're giving us is no good, and we know that the last few checks you've given us are no good, and we need to ask you not to come into our liquor store anymore. And as humiliating as that was, my only thought was, oh, God, I hope he gives me this whiskey. And they did give me the whiskey, and I walked back around the corner, and there was a concrete landing, and as I walked around that corner, I had that alcohol in my hand, the whiskey in my hand, and by this time I'm not drinking Wild Turkey 101, and whatever it was, and suddenly something happened, it slipped out of my hand and hit that concrete below and spilled all over the ground. And I was more hopeless and helpless in that moment than I ever had been in a firefight in Vietnam, because I had no weapon to fight back with. And all this rage started coming up in me, because I was so angry at this God that had rejected me when I was younger, that had caused me to live like this. And I blamed God for this. And I started screaming at the top of my lungs, God blanket, God blanket, God blanket. And something happened, and I broke, and I started yelling, God help me, God help me, God help me. And when I did, I had a moment of peace. And there was a scene from another movie I'd seen 50 times called Days of Wine and Roses, where Jack Klugman walks up to Jack Lemmon and says, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. And that scene was bigger and more real to me than anything else that had been going on. It was like I was in the middle of that. And I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner. I didn't have a nickel. And I called the operator. And I was crying. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. That's exactly what I said to the operator. But because somebody here had taken the message to the people that worked at the phone company, she said, hold on just a minute. She connected me with an office where there was a woman who had been working there, had just started working there a year or two earlier. Her name was Helen. And Helen said, honey, I know you're hurting. I know you're in trouble. You wait right there. I'm going to send somebody out to talk to you. And if Helen hadn't answered the phone live, not get a recording that tells me I could call back and make an appointment to see if I'm an alcoholic, if Helen hadn't answered the phone, I wouldn't be here. And she sent out a guy named Ed. And Ed was, I'm getting ready to either kill myself or there's a possibility I'll talk to Ed. Ed shows up. Ed was the kind of guy I wouldn't normally associate with. He worked for the railroad. He lived at the Darlington in a one-room apartment with a hot plate, but he had a brand new car, you know, alcoholics are. And so it wasn't much of a car. It was a Pinto, but it had the sticker on the side. And Ed came out, and he had a bad toupee, a pipe, and I remember a striped shirt and plaid pants. And bad on some. And so I I'm looking at this guy, and he comes up, and I'm thinking, I don't want to talk to this guy. And really, you know, and if you're going out some standards, I mean, God, you know. And so he comes up, and he starts talking to me. But Ed had read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was on fire with trying to help other alcoholics get sober. And Ed had gone to a place called Peachford. And so he starts talking to me, and Ed says, do you have insurance? I said, oh, of course. And so, which I obviously didn't. And he said, well, we're going to take you. I'm going to take you to this place. He said, will you be okay? It was a hot day. It was June the 8th, 1977, 33 years ago last month. And they're going to take me to he's going to take me to a place to dry out because I hadn't had anything to drink and I was vibrating. And he recognized that I needed some help. And he actually gave me some alcohol to drink to get me to the, which we used to do on 12-step calls, on wet calls, to get me to Peachford. And they take me to Peachford. On the way there, he said, I'm going to stop right here because I'm going to use, they just come out with ATM machines. And apparently where I was living, they hadn't sent me a card. But he said, I'm going to stop at this ATM machine and I'm going to get some money. And I said, huh? He said, yeah, I take this card and I put it in that machine. And it gives me some money. You know, and the thought occurs to me, if I had one of those, I wouldn't need to be in this car going to a, but anyway, so I went with him. He said, will you be okay? And I said, sure. And, but it was hot. And so before he could get back, I had thrown up down the inside of his window on a brand new car with a sticker on it. And the only thing Ed did was come over and put his arm around me and say, it's going to be okay. If he'd done anything to reject me or judge me, because I was just waiting for that to turn away, I would have walked away. That's why it's so important to love the new people who come in here. Nobody ever told me to shut up. From the day I got here, people constantly told me that I belong. And made me feel like I was loved and like I was worth something. They always did that for me because I didn't need somebody to tell me I wasn't worth something by the time I got here. And so Ed took me to this place and they start to dry me out. I had DTs for about 4 or 5 days. It appeared to me that the ugliest man in the universe was standing there holding my hands, and then I woke up and it was Joe Hubbard. And he was this little guy. He was kind of a spunky looking guy. And he was, but what I learned from Joe is if somebody's going through DTs, if you'll put your hand on them, it takes you out of the delusions. And he did that for me. And he stayed with me. And he said, the good guys are going to win now. And I knew what he meant by that. Because I knew there were two people inside of me, and I didn't want to be the person I had been. And so he waited with me, and a guy named Conway came in, and Conway said, now, we found out you don't actually have insurance. Duh. And so this is how long ago, well, the entire stay cost $2,800, and Conway said, well, you can just pay us back. We understand you had a good job at one point. We'll just let you pay us back when you get out of here. So that's a long time ago. But people started doing things like that for me. And the big book says when we take that third step, that if we're willing, God will take care of. And then I looked up and there's this beautiful woman that had 30 or 40 years sobriety. And I just thought, boy, is she beautiful. And I wonder what it's like to have that much serenity. And it was Tony. And she had a year and a half. But that was a lot more than I had. And so so most of the staff there had a year or 2 years or whatever, but they were all in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got no bad information. Everything I got was about the big book and so forth. Now, I had brain damage. It took me about a year and a half to learn how to read after I got here because of the kind of drinking I had done. I'd torn up my digestive system, and I had caused some brain damage. And so I couldn't really work anyplace, and I had no job. I was homeless. So when they got me out of Peachford, they sent me to Louisville, Kentucky, my hometown, and they gave me a sponsor before I arrived there. His name was Jack Sullivan. He was another railroad man, and he knew a lot of the people there. So they sent me off to meet with him, and somebody gave me a car to drive. You know, God provides whatever you need. Somebody gave me a car to drive up there. I don't know, remember who, but it got me up there. And then I found a place to stay. When I got up there, there was a man who had a basement apartment. He put me in the apartment. I had one bunk, and there was another bunk next to me, and we didn't have a treatment center, so when new drunks came in and they 12-stepped them, I would stay up with them all night because the rest of them all had regular, you know, adult-type jobs. And so I had a place to stay. I had some meals. I poured coffee at one of those clubs where you have AA meetings, and I made enough money to pay for my cigarettes, and I had everything I needed. But the most important thing I needed was I was around a group of men that took me. I went to 9 meetings a week, and they were 8 of them were speaker meetings, and one of them was a 12-and-12 meeting. In the 12-and-12 meeting, we read the big book or the 12-and-12 on one step or one tradition each week. If you had worked that step or tradition, you could share your experience. If not, you could ask a question. There was no time during any meeting where it was possible, unless you were talking during the speaker, for me to get bad information. It was all Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why I still believe in solution meetings. And so that was the gift that I was given. Our conversations took place afterwards at the Howard Johnsons, where the AAs and the Al-Anons and the Alateens all went out. We may be at different tables, but it was family recovery. And that was the gift that I was given, and it enabled me to get sober. Now, the other thing that I got, and if you're brand new, that I would recommend that you get, especially the two people that picked up, is a job in your home group. If you just go late and leave early, you're not connected. I got a job. And in Louisville, Kentucky at that time, first of all, as I said, I had brain damage. I couldn't really do much with math, so they wouldn't let me do anything that required that kind of skill, like make the coffee. And so, but in Louisville, Kentucky at that time, if you came into AA and you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learn how to smoke. And so... I was the ashtray guy for my home group, and we had those little round ashtrays that were like Christmas tree colors. They were gold, green, blue, and gold, and red. And we had 10 of them, and I had a Brillo pad, and they were designed so that the ashes would chemically fuse with the metal when it went in there. It was kind of corrugated. But I was the ashtray guy, and I got those ashtrays looking good and shiny, and I developed a good technique with it, and I was extremely good as an ashtray guy, and I was actually prouder of being the ashtray guy in my home group than I was of being the youngest creative director for that ad agency in New York, because one was real and the other wasn't. This is the first time in my entire life, before I drank or when I drank, that I really had real experiences, and I had real laughter, and I had real friends, and it was all real. Where I was in touch with people. And I was learning how to love people unconditionally by working with these drunks. You'd stay up with them all night. Lots of them would go back out there. At first that bothered me. Then it was pointed out that I was staying sober. And so I would learn how to love them unconditionally. I was learning that in Alcoholics Anonymous. All the things that other people learn before they get here in this life, I learned when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they took me every place with them. Jack spoke at a lot of conferences. I went all over the place with him, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a very good member for a year and a half, because that was during the time when I was brain dead, and I just did whatever you told me to do. And so, and then my brain started working a little bit, and I learned several things. I learned about rotation. They came up and they said, we have a new guy, and he is going to be the new ashtray guy. And I said, I don't think so. And they said, oh, no, he really needs the job, but we're going to make you the chairperson. I'm going to be the chairperson? No, the chairperson. And so... But Alcoholics Anonymous is fair. We only had 10 ashtrays, and we had 40 chairs. So this is a promotion. And so, but I had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. The entire time I've been sober, I've had a job of some sort or another in Alcoholics Anonymous to be useful to other people in my home group and elsewhere, with the exception of 3 years. Between 12 and 15 years of sobriety, I got a little burned out because I was very two-dimensional on that 12th step when I first got here. I didn't recognize the practicing these principles in all our affairs. I thought it meant get sober and get everybody else sober, so that's what I was doing. And after a while, I was still at odds with a lot of people, a lot of things. I'd never studied the traditions, and so I was having trouble. And when I was 12 years sober, I decided to deal with some issues and have a little me time. By the time I was 15 years sober, I was suicidal in a hotel room in Los Angeles trying to find a gun. And as God would have it, I was in California. I really didn't realize how difficult it is to find a gun in California. Here we just go to a gun show. And I prayed out to God, and I said, God, help me, when I was out there at that point. And the thought, go to a meeting every night. And I went to the meeting the first night, and a guy named Tom Whalen spoke, and Tom got up and said he had about 20 years when he ran into a tough spot, and that he had had to come back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had a little bit of depression, a little bit of feeling disconnected. And then the next guy was a guy named Cliff. And each night, somebody with more time than me got up and talked about reaching a rough spot at somewhere between 15 and 25 years of sobriety. So if you've been around here for a while and you've hit a tough spot, don't worry. It happens to a lot of people. It happened to Bill Wilson. I just had to start over. But I had great sponsorship. I had Bill Roop was my sponsor up until the time that I started feeling like I needed more stuff. And then I stopped talking to him. And I was so embarrassed at not talking to him that when I got ready to come back at that point, I got John Holmes because he was over there, and then I had to go apologize to Bill Roop and tell him why I hadn't been talking to him because I hadn't really been doing the deal. Now, I didn't drink. I was fortunate enough that I didn't drink, but I mentioned that. Now, here I am. I'm getting back to getting sober, and my brain is starting to work. Now I start working through the steps. I was told that the program is what gets us sober. I didn't hear don't drink and go to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings, but I was told that I needed to continue to grow and to work these steps. Well, my first three inventories, I had only one resentment. It was the same girl on all three. I don't even remember who it was now, but apparently I was ticked at her. And so, but now I do an inventory and I realize I'm angry at everybody. I mean, if you grow up feeling like you're separated from humans and separated from God, there's not a whole lot of warmth. And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, it's a cold, dark place. And that's the way I was inside. And so I was angry at everybody for everything. And I started, I finally realized what I needed to do, and I started making amends. And I went back to that Linden Baptist Church where I felt like God turned his back on me, and I made amends. And this is where the miracles start to happen, is in the ninth step. And that's where the promises that they will start to happen. And I got up on a Sunday night, and I apologized to that Baptist church for what I had said about them and for the way I had acted towards them and what I'd called them. And as I did, there were two things that happened. One, I found a group of people that loved me unconditionally, the same as they as you had in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that I was a child of God, not only in here, but outside of here. And I wasn't just restricted to being comfortable in AA meetings. And they started being, these people loved me. And they actually helped me get, I was broke, and they helped me get home for Christmas that year. And they did a number of wonderful things. And I realized that the world was a lot bigger than strictly inside our fellowship. The second thing that happened, I was looking for a significant other. I was looking for a new dancer that needed spiritual guidance. And but in the watching me that night in the church was a girl who was two things I was not looking for, a good girl and a seminary student. But because I allowed God to put me together with somebody, that person and I have been married for 26 years, and she was your Al-Anon speaker today. And I met her doing a... I met her not trying to cruise and see who I could find at the young people's dance. I met her while I was making amends to a church. And my experience has been almost every good thing that has come to me has been while I have been working a step or being useful to somebody else, and then without me knowing it, some other part of my life was supplied and taken care of in a way that I would never have been able to create. Now, I go through I had any number of amends that surprised me. I apologized to the comptroller of this ad agency. I actually came to Atlanta to do that because that was the last place I had worked, and apologized and told them that I had cheated on my expense account, and I didn't know how much money, but I thought I owed them $30,000, and I didn't even wear any jewelry because I thought I was going to jail. And her name was Heartless. We called her Heartless because she was so tough on everybody. And I didn't get the reaction I thought I was going to get. She started crying. She said, "Did you know that there were a group of us who knew you were in trouble and we had been praying for you?" And suddenly we realized that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And I go to make a final amends at this one church that I had actually defaced when I was in high school. I was so angry. And I'd torn up the place. And I went in there trying to find somebody to apologize to. And I couldn't find anybody. The chapel was open. There wasn't a soul in there. And suddenly it occurred to me who I was there for. I had been, in the early couple years, asking God in the morning. I was told to do this at Peachford. Asking God in the morning to keep me sober and thanking God at night. But I was still angry at this guy. And even though God hadn't done anything to harm me, I had to forgive God. So I got on my knees and I started forgiving God and had one of the most profound spiritual experiences I've ever had. I felt like I weighed nothing. I felt like there was a breeze was actually blowing through my soul. All of that anxiety and the fear and the things that I had carried so many years, the things that I used alcohol to temporarily take away, started falling off my back and out of my gut. And I felt like I was a child of God. And from that day until now, I haven't not known that. And I was, for the first time, united with this loving, kind Father and that was my God. And you had taught me how to unite with people because I would love an alcoholic unconditionally. And then as I learned it from you, I could slowly take that and apply it to my family, to other places. I was learning to love people. I was learning to love God. And I was learning not to love things nearly as much. I had always loved things because it was the only thing I could get, and I didn't know how to deal with anything else. And you were teaching me that. And now I'm having the spiritual awakening. I feel like I belong. The guys that I got sober with went on an annual house cleaning, and they went to Gethsemane, which was a Trappist monastery, and it was a quiet place. I had read a lot about it because in the 60s I did a lot of reading of Thomas Merton, some of the other people. I was always seeking. And so Thomas Merton was at Gethsemane. He had died by the time I got there, but that was his residence. And so I went down there, and we had this. I'd been to one or two of these, and at this particular retreat, the priest comes out, and there are about 12 or 15 of us, and he says, you boys know what God's will is, don't you? And see, I've had this spiritual awakening. Now I'm seeking God's will. What is God's will for me? And nobody ventured to guess, and he said, God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can right now with what you've got to be useful to others. If you're a father, be a good father. If you're a brother, be a good brother. If you're a son, be a good son. If you have a job that you absolutely love and you're good at it, serve people honorably in that job until God gives you something else. If you have a job that you absolutely hate, serve people honorably and love people through that job until God gives you something else. And a little light went on. And he says, we're God's children. And God thinks of us, loves us even more than we love our own children. But he treats us the same way. And if you men had two boys, 7 years old, and you gave them both a little red wagon, and one took that red wagon around the neighborhood and spread joy to the other kids, and the other kid took that red wagon and kicked it aside and said, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? And a light went on. I had always been the kid who would take whatever you gave me and kick it aside because I wanted something else. If I was dating this girl, I wanted that girl. If I had this job, I wanted that job. If I had this car, I wanted another car. I made an art out of it on cocktail napkins because I was never satisfied with who I was or what I had. And the best way for me to please God was just to do the best I could with what I had. And that's so simple and yet sometimes so tough. But it changed my life. And I moved back here, Barbara and I got married, and from that point on I can tell you that many, many miracles have happened because I've just known those few simple things. There is one who has all power, that one is God. And if I know that, and I remember that, and I remember though I don't have power, but I have access because my Father will give me what I need if I'm willing just to do what he asks of me, the simple things he asks of me, and that's to love whoever I'm close to do the very best I can to be useful to anybody that I see. And to not let a human being go by that doesn't know that there is a God that loves them and there's hope in their life. That's all I have to do. And God takes care of everything I need. And because of that, we've seen great power. And we've seen also great challenges. Some of you know or don't know that last night we had an open house at our home that we weren't expecting. My friend Johnny went by to feed the dogs and found out somebody had broken into our home, taken all our computers, taken a bunch of firearms, taken a bunch of video equipment, ransacked the house, and so forth. But I didn't get angry. I went there. I had to be with the police up until 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm a little sleep deprived right now, but there was no point in me getting angry about it. There was no point in me getting upset about it. God's going to provide whatever I need. But that's a little thing. In 2005, Barbara and I went through an experience where we never had any children, weren't able to have any. We had a dog that we loved named Burger Bear who'd gone to about 200 or 300 AA events with us, and we had to put him to sleep. And we thought that was the toughest thing that was going to happen. I held him in my arms and then I buried him next to the lake where we live. And we were crying and it really is an experience because dogs never, never say anything bad to you. And so you grow this attachment. And within a few weeks, Barbara's mom and dad both died within a week of each other. And many of you were here and you came and supported us. And it was a shock because we were the caretakers for them. And when you're caretakers, they're almost like children. It's more like losing a child than it is. And we were shocked by that because both were unexpected. But, you know, one had Alzheimer's and the other was on the way there. And they didn't want to live like that. And they both had quick heart attacks and they were gone. They were in paradise. And so we look back on it, and God was very merciful, and that was, and they wanted to be together. My mom died not too long after that, but her body was worn out too, and she had a good long life here. But we went to Toronto, and as I said, we've been to 7 internationals now, and I never want to miss one. And we went to Toronto, and I came back from that, and I was told that I had esophageal cancer and on a physical. And if you know anything about esophageal cancer, it's the only cancer that has worse rates than pancreatic cancer. And so less than 1% of people survive it. It's a very rare cancer. And so I couldn't tell Barbara that I had this cancer because she just lost her mom and dad, and we put our dog to sleep. It's like a country western song. But even she'd had all this loss in her life, and so I couldn't tell her that. And because I couldn't tell her that, I couldn't tell you that because you don't gossip. And so the only people that knew were my sponsor, my prayer partner, Keith Lewis, another guy that I prayed with, Ed Mutum, and a couple of medical people. And so we were searching and praying. And they told me at first that I should just, you know, it was the same thing they told Tony, that it was, you know, you might as well get your affairs in order. But I didn't accept that. And we started looking. And we found a place, the one place in the United States where they had some success with a new procedure, not called a pull-up, but where they actually remove 2/3 of your stomach, and they form a whole new esophagus, and they rebuild your digestive system, and it's a long thing, and it's nasty, but when it gets done, you know, I'm obviously not shrinking, and so it was out in University of Southern California. Now, in the 12th step, it tells me that I should pray for God's will. But I was doing some homework for God, so I had decided that I was supposed to be going out to this place out there and that I wasn't going to just give up and that I was going to go to this place at USC and so forth. And we get a second opinion out there, and he says, yes, we can help you. And then they call back and they say, we can't take your insurance. And I was stunned, and I thought, I'm going to die because I don't have the right kind of insurance. And I was speaking on that Saturday night in a place in Key West and at a conference, and I ended up not being able to pray at all. And once you come in here and you feel that terrific bathing and you feel like you're one of God's children and you see the sunlight of the Spirit, which I'd never done. I didn't go back to something when I came to AA. I'd never had that before I got here. And once you feel that attachment, that conscious contact, and you feel connected and it's taken away from you, it is never so dark. It was never that dark, even in the worst of my drinking. Because for 2 days, I felt absolutely separated from God. Because I doubted God, and I was angry, and I thought that I was going to die because God couldn't arrange to get me into this place to get the procedure done. And so a friend of mine said, just pray. I couldn't even pray. And he said, pray whatever you can. And I remembered the 23rd Psalm that I had memorized for the PTA in the third grade, and I started saying it over and over, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And as I said it, slowly before, just about a half an hour before I was supposed to speak, all of a sudden some peace hit me, because this scene where I talked with my original sponsor, Jack Sullivan, the day that he had walked out and been told he had 6 malignant brain tumors and that he knew that they were inoperable, I talked to him and I said, Jack, I don't sense any fear. And he said, if God has been this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting for me on the other side. The big book says we will lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. And I don't think it says that by mistake. They meant that. And so suddenly I just relaxed. And if I'm going to go on and I'm going to be someplace and I'm going to paradise, you guys keep going to meetings, I'll save you a seat over there. And that's the way I felt when I got up to speak, and that's basically what I said. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me, but I was not concerned about it because I knew God would take care of Barbara. And we got back, and on that Monday morning I had a phone call back from California, and I thought, oh, they're going to change their mind. And they said, we still can't take you, but our chief of surgery just left here to go to Rochester, New York, and he's at the hospital up there connected with the university. Why don't you call him? And so I did call him, although still a little skeptical because I can't even get my primary care physician to call me back, but I'm going to call the chief of surgery. But an hour later, the chief of surgery at Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, New York, did call me back. And he said, we don't care about your insurance. I'm trying to teach some of these doctors here this procedure. If you will come, I'll do the surgery myself. And so I then had to tell Barbara, and we got in a car. I told her I had cancer, and we got in a car to drive up to New York, and I was concerned. We didn't know anybody up there. And when we got to the parking lot, there were about 30 people there, and we had a new home group in AA and a new home group in Al-Anon, and they did Barbara's laundry, and they took care of us 24 hours a day. And we went to the meeting with them that night, and we felt, you know, we felt like we were home again. The next morning we go to the hospital. The first thing we did was go to the chapel because we wanted to pray and turn this over to God. And I can tell you, I had some fear. And up on the wall, in letters that were a foot and a half deep in gold, it says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And we walked out into the lobby. And the name of the hospital is Strong Memorial Hospital, endowed by the family of Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, without whom we wouldn't have the Alcoholic Foundation, and we wouldn't, and I wouldn't have been here the first time. My experience is that if I am allowing to God to take care of the details in my life, that if I just trust God, as simple as that, and it says, trust God and clean house, and be useful to others, God can work out all the details, no matter how difficult they are. If that's not a miracle, I don't know what is. And because it happened to me, it happened to Tony. And sitting on the front row, Tony had pancreatic cancer. So if people tell you that you can't live with esophageal cancer or pancreatic cancer or have four pipe bombs blow up in your face and still live, they're wrong, because they're not members of Alcoholics Anonymous and they don't know where the power is. I am a poster boy up there. They call me. The doctors call me. They like to see, during the first year or two, one of the problems with people with esophageal cancer since they rebuild the system is that we can't gain our weight back. They don't have that many obsessive alcoholic people who eat Nutter Butters and high-calorie juice all day long either. But I'm a poster boy. I'm one of their success stories, because I had a fatal disease, and I have lived through that fatal disease. Well, guess what? Everybody in this room who's not an Al-Anon member, and some of you are going to be, some of you are welcome, or we have some transfers that go from one program to another, but everybody in here who is an AA member has a fatal disease, and you are sitting here in the middle of a fatal disease, having fun, enjoying things, looking forward to what you're going to do. So what is the problem? There is not a problem. We can go to paradise on one hand, we can live a great life here, or you can sit around and not accept the gifts that God's trying to give you right this moment, here and now. All you have to do is recognize who has the power. But I will tell you this, what I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not enough for me to come into this program and just say, I got a new girlfriend and I got a new car, look at me, ain't I doing grand? Because the only reason that God got me sober and saved my life, and I've had two fatal diseases. I had peritonitis for 6 days back in 2001 with a misdiagnosed ruptured appendix, and they told the family to get ready to bury me then too. But the only reason I'm still here is because God has a purpose for me. And God has a purpose for me in loving other people, in writing, in talking, in doing all the things I do. And everybody in here has their own purpose. God has something planned for them. And if you're not sure of what it is, let your sponsor help you find out who you are and what your talents are and start using them for other people, and you will experience something you've never experienced before. It is called joy. We talk about it in the 12 and 12. It says joy is the theme and action is the key word. If you will take the actions, you will find joy. Joy is that feeling. It's different than high. It's different than happy. It's the feeling that I absolutely belong, that I've got a kind and loving God that has all power, who can hurt me, and I don't need to worry about what happens to me in life, whether they rifle through my house or anything else. I don't have to worry about my money or not money. It takes away all of those things. It gives me a purpose to be useful. And there are a lot of useful people in this room, and that's why there's so many people with long-term sobriety. Get to know them and follow them. And if you do, you will have the greatest ride of your life. For those two people that just picked up that book and thought that this was just about not taking a drink, I need to tell you that we still live in the age of miracles. That's what the big book says. Our own recovery proves that. Happy 35th roundup, happy 75th anniversary, and please don't leave before you find your miracle.